It is Saturday, November 3rd, 2007, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, the week in geek news, and in the second half, your questions and comments of technology. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today, we're covering the week in geek news, and during the second half of the show, I'll welcome you to join our conversation. You can ask us anything you'd like. The numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Or go to geekspeak.org right now to send us email. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. Geek Speak on KUSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks Drew Meyer, product manager at Network Appliance. Hello, Drew.
Good morning, Lyle. Good
morning. How you doing, man?
Pretty good. Good to be here. Thanks.
And Miles Elam, Slacker geek and student.
Good morning.
Good morning, Miles. Miles, you're using your iPod instead of the headphones?
No,
I mean, you're using your little iBud things instead of these big headphones, because these are what, like 70s style and you want to use current day?
No, it's because my other option were these...
Yeah, 60 style.
60 style.
I know he's listening to the show on the podcast a little advanced.
He'll be slightly delayed today.
Ryder Brooks, support engineer at Sun Microsystems. Morning, Ryder.
What do you mean I'll be delayed?
A little good. Geek humor to start the morning out there.
Try that in an hour.
Oh, we kill ourselves out here, folks.
Man, I don't get the podcast up for hours and hours. Anyway.
Sometimes it seems like we're just amusing ourselves. Like,
I know.
You know, who cares about the listening audience?
You know, let me turn the transmitter off. Morning.
Let's get rolling here. Let's get rolling as if we were a DARPA Urban Challenge robot. How about that, huh?
All right.
So today, about an hour ago, the DARPA Urban Challenge kicked off. You can go to grandchallenge.org to see status and get information about this. This is where the government is paying for individual citizens to do research, or teams of citizens to do research on robot-directed automobiles. So you can drive around a city or a town with no driver and obey all the traffic rules.
Now, the earlier tests were all done out in the desert.
I think it's also a different challenge, technically. I mean, that's for, like, you know, shock and awe kind of tanks rolling across the desert in a big storm. But this is more like urban warfare, it sounds like. The starting gate, like I said, it started this morning. 11 driverless cars on a 10-mile course at a former Air Force base.
So it's not out in the wild.
It's not. It's designed. I mean, and there's guys with clipboards standing out on the street watching them, make sure that they complete the test successfully. And if they don't, then there's very good speculation that they'll be disqualified or lose points. Or, you know, the whole point is to follow the rules.
Now, in these kind of tests, are there like big red buttons you can turn all the cars off anytime you want?
That's a great question. There is an e-stop, an emergency stop button that you can push, which will shut a car, one of these robots, down immediately in case they, you know, connect
to someone that can kill the brains.
Right, in case Skynet takes over and they all start turning on their creators.
Interesting. So so we'll see how the outcome of that is. But it's probably going to be functional. These people we're getting better at driving cars automatically.
We're dramatically better. I think there'll be some video posted later on today. I'm sure there will be. You know, just check out the internet, check out the web if you want to see. It's pretty shocking and impressive how far we've come in the last few years. And, you know, it's the dawn of artificial intelligence, if you will, for in real life applications.
Yeah. Cool. Thank you very much.
You bet.
Yeah. Ryder, hi.
Hi. So, looks like Blockbuster is going to be taking a hit here. They've, you know, they've been competing with Netflix, you know, the online DVD rental.
Sure.
And I have a friend that works at Netflix, and, you know, he's been there for a few years, and he's kind of, you know, told me about the sagas with Blockbuster, Arch Enemy, and Blockbuster, I guess, announced some quarterly results, and they're doing quite badly. Their revenue slipped 5.7%. They lost, like, $35 million this quarter. And overall, they've closed over 500 stores in the last year.
Whoa.
So they're kind of really tanking. And the CEO admits basically it's been their focus on trying to compete and dominate against Netflix that's kind of driven them down.
They did an amazing deal with their Blockbuster online service where you can get the same deal, same price basically, and same idea of the DVDs come to your house like Netflix, except that you can additionally take those discs and bring them into a store and get them translated.
Some extra flexibility. They've had the problem of their sort of self-censorship of their titles in the past.
The stores are
the religiously
worst.
Affiliated. And they've removed, they don't stock some movies, and I guess they've rumored to have edited content of movies as well.
Interesting.
We used to be Netflix customers, and my wife has a very, very low tolerance for poor quality videos, whether they're scratched or skippy, because you're three quarters of the way through and the thing conks out.
It's
and
the
you,
worst.
You spend in 45 minutes, whatever. So we ended up giving up and saying, there's a Blockbuster down the street. We'll just deal with that. And we were reminded the whole reason why we left Blockbuster in the first place is because the stores are so frustrating to work with. There are some people in there who know about movies, but the selection's never what we want. And
yeah,
it's just kind of,
man, talk about kicking a company while they're down.
I have no patience.
I am do not like Blockbuster.
No, and Netflix is the whole business idea was brilliant, and they've successfully executed on it. And I figured when Blockbuster got into the game that Netflix would suffer, and I'm kind of happy to see the little local guy surviving there. Yeah, well, relatively speaking.
Well, Blockbuster had like weird little fine print rules. Like you had to you couldn't like. Do like Netflix, you couldn't hold it on indefinitely, or they'd charge you some fee that they'd hold on your credit card until you returned it. Fine print, I forget what it was like a year or two ago.
Where it changed over a bit, but
yeah. But their late fees were always problematic for me. I mean, I actually, before they went online, I would use Blockbuster occasionally and return movies, you know, the night before. They had their silly, you know, three evenings out, but it's really, what, 2.5 evenings?
Right.
And I kind of last minute, maybe had like a half hour before they closed, and I returned like three movies, and
they would
come in a week later and found out I got dinged like $15 or something for that, and there's no way that they would basically let you fight it because it was their word against yours.
It's so frustrating. I think it's fascinating. Where do consumers get the idea that late fees are oppressive? I mean, you're borrowing this thing that they make money with, the more of them they have on the shelf and the titles, but we have this perception that late fees are a bad thing. And the simplicity that Netflix has brought to the model, combined with the lack of fees, has completely dominated all the infrastructure that Blockbuster spent millions and years building overnight. In 2 years, I should
Blockbuster,
say.
Blockbuster, at least the one that I go to in Scotts Valley, has no more late fees, or at least that's what they say. Because I was late, extremely late. You know, one of the kids put it behind stuff. I came in, they're like, no, we don't do that anymore. Just try to get it in. And that was really interesting because, of course, there is a giant loss for them if they don't have stock on the shelf.
They got to pay those guys to stand there at the counter and keep the lights on.
And I think they got so much hit from it, they decided to just eat it up. And I guess it's affecting them.
Well, you know, on the other end is the people that use Netflix, and I've known several people that do that, where they have, you know, gone to their house and they've got the same title there for like 4 months.
Right,
you know,
they paid for three
months, and they just go, I just don't use it. And they don't seem to know that Netflix is, they really want you to use it. Well, they want you to keep things. They want you to, you know, use their service. But the feedback I got from Netflix is, you know, they're thrilled if you use it. They don't really want you to just sit on stuff.
Right, and, because eventually you'll just turn off the service.
Yeah. I've been incredibly, for me personally, I've heard of people, my friends, I tell them, you know, go in or call them and tell them, you know, you're not using it, and they'll refund your money for the time that you didn't use it. They've been pretty flexible. I mean, they were, you know, 3-4 years ago. I don't know where they are now, but.
Well, I really assumed that when Blockbuster got into the game with Netflix, that Netflix would just disappear.
Suffer, yeah.
So it's interesting that they haven't in the Blockbuster.
Well, they designed that model, you know, is their
and they didn't design
their brainchild, and they do it very well, and there's a lot of science behind it.
So we're all thinking about this from the perspective of people watching the same amount of movies. Do you think people are watching less movies and people are doing more online time or something else?
Yeah. I would actually, well, That's the funny thing. With regard to entertainment, I think TV watching has changed quite a bit because you have the internet. You have something that is interactive, that you're taking an active role. But I've definitely gone to the movies less.
Yeah.
Well, to the theater.
Yeah. To the theater, yeah.
You still spend the same amount of hours in front of
the
movie.
But then again, the theaters, a lot of the reason why I don't go there so much anymore is because I remember not too long ago when it was like $4 to go to a movie, and now it's getting closer to $10. So
I went to a matinee with my kids yesterday. Oops, I wasn't working. And spent, I think, $21 just for me and the two kids to get in.
At a matinee.
At a matinee. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I have to do the cheapest possible. So,
well, yeah. I mean, there's the argument of, but the theaters have this great sound, they have a huge screen, and at the same time, I wonder if it's worth it for me. Like, I think of the older theaters that didn't have as good a sound. They still had good sound, but not as immersive a sound, and I would be willing to go see it there.
What about, like, historic theaters like the Del Mar here in Santa Cruz that's been refurbished, and it doesn't have maybe the most up-to-date, state-of-the-art seating and sound systems and all that, but there's a feeling and a characteristic that goes along with it that I'm perfectly willing to pay for.
Yeah, sure.
And the titles that they bring are way more interesting.
I love the social experience of everyone going to watch that movie, and I wish there was more social in terms of people talking about it afterwards, not just
during.
The movie is over. Well, not necessarily during, but after the movie is over.
That's why we don't go to movies.
Yeah. Yeah. But after the movie is over, right now it's, all right, the movie's over, now get out.
Yeah.
And, I don't know, it'd be nice to, you know, see the movie and then have some place to hang out as a movie-going experience, like as a community experience.
Well, these newer theaters, as they get all high-tech and they have this awesome sound, they're also packing all the theaters next to each other. And what I hate about, like, the Cinema 9 locally is that you can hear the theater next to you.
Yeah.
And the bass bleeds through, and that's really distracting to me.
Yeah. Especially when you're watching a slow, quiet scene.
And romantic, and just Transformers is playing next to us.
And you can hear the laughter of, you know,
right.
The
and the moral of the story is, go see Transformers instead of the quiet.
The schmaltzy stuff. That's Miles' opinion.
Emotive movie.
All right, let's get on with something that's more geeky. Thank you very much for that new story about Netflix and Blockbuster.
We're getting about emotions there. I got to run away.
Miles?
Going back to school, it's reminded me of the disdain that many educators have of Wikipedia as a citation source. I mean, it may be something that they say, yeah, go there to look, but you never cite Wikipedia. The reason being is
In academia.
Because you're never sure of its veracity. You're never sure if it's actually right or if someone had just written some random thing in there. And I've actually found Wikipedia to be a great resource. And when people compared it against things like Britannica, they found that in terms of history or government that it lags behind. But in terms of science, it's spot on. In fact, more accurate than Britannica. Well, instead of fighting against it, the University of Washington Bethel professor Martha Groom decided she was going to take a more active role. And instead of telling her students, you are not allowed to use Wikipedia as a source, the assignment was find your information and edit or create a new Wikipedia page. So take a page that is demonstrably wrong and edit it to fill it out, or create a whole new one if you can't find a topic that's of use. And not only does this make Wikipedia better and more accurate, but she found that the quality of her students' work improved dramatically, because it was no longer just write a paper and submit it to your professor and, you know, just do
and
what
it has
you need
no,
to do.
It has no meaning in the world kind of thing. It's just between you and your professor.
You have something that you are submitting to a massive peer review. Mm-hmm. You're doing something that is going to be a resource for a large number of people.
It's not just homework. It's not just for your own edification.
Exactly. And found that the quality of work dramatically improved because of it.
Makes sense.
So the students did their own research is what you're saying. So the skills were still practiced and taught.
Right. They still had to cite their sources, which Wikipedia actually encourages, saying citation needed. But it was instead of fighting against Wikipedia, instead of just ignoring it, instead of just dismissing it, it was actively engaging with it to make it better.
Interesting.
And who knows in the future, and this is something that Wikipedia has been working on, is another version of Wikipedia, Veripedia, that is all the Wikipedia articles that have remained stable, that have gone through some review and aren't constantly rolling over in terms of edits, going into a more stable Veripedia, a true encyclopedia, if you will, that has fewer articles, but those articles, you're more sure of their veracity.
Very cool. Thank you very much, Miles, for that update. Drew, what are you doing tomorrow?
Tomorrow, I will be a featured guest on Tech Talk Radio.
And what is Tech Talk Radio?
Tech Talk Radio is a Tucson show. You can read more about it at techtalkradio.com. This is a work appearance for me, talking about small and medium business storage products remotely over the phone, just like I'll be on the other side of the console from what we usually do here at Geek Speak. Pretty fun. Thanks, Lyle, for the plug there.
Certainly. So what time's it on?
It'll be on, you can read it, you can see the stream at techtalkradio.com. Now, why they stream a radio program that where I'll be, you know, on the phone is kind of bizarre, but whatever. They've got a camera in their studio. And you can also go to techtalkradio.com and listen live or check out the podcast.
Have you sent them a photo display while you're talking?
I have. There's a photo and a bio and all that, which I've sent to them, and I assume that they'll be putting it somewhere.
All right. Yes. So you're pretty experienced with what we do here at Geek Speak. So are they like highbrow kind of, you know, on top of it? They actually asked for a bio and like set you up. The interview was set up like before last
night.
Well,
yeah. We have a PR group at NetApp, and they got all this stuff together for me. So, you know, they just hand it off, and I show up. And
you're a celebrity. That's cool.
It's a pre-scripted.
No, yeah. I already know everything I'm going to say. No, it'll be live, and they do some call-in. It's the format is pretty similar to this, but I think it's a little bit maybe less fun, certainly less entertaining.
Let's see a little sample. They won't ask simple questions like this, but I've got, what's the difference between a NAS and a SAN, and what are they?
Okay, well, so Drew, the marketing guy, is going to say, Lyle, why would you need to know that? Because a product from Network Appliance does both at the same time and takes the whole difficulty of the conversation right off the table.
Let me remind you, you're not working for NetApp right now.
Now.
Go on.
So in the GeekSpeak world, the difference between a NAS and a SAN is that the storage is available to the people who want to use it in two different ways. And in storage, we say block versus file or block level versus file protocol level is the way that storage is addressed. From a user standpoint, one way, a NAS acts like a file server. So you use file protocols like SIFS for Windows and NFS for Unix.
This is like finding a share on another person's computer,
right,
and
so,
accessing the files.
So you reach across the network to that computer. It has the data and the files that you want, and it looks like it's a network share on your computer.
Right.
And most people, if you have most people are familiar with this because at work they have like a P drive or a Q drive. And
right.
That's where the IT guy says, put all your stuff, it'll be backed up. That's actually sitting on a computer somewhere else. A SAN is storage that's available directly to an application, and only that application on that particular server gets to access that storage. And so an example like that is most regular end users don't ever see that. It's more an IT admin kind of a function.
Can you also think of it as like an external hard drive that's really external? It's plugging in a USB drive where...
A USB drive is a block-level device. It doesn't show up as a network share on your computer. It shows up as a local drive on your computer. So that's capacity that's available to your machine and your machine only and only those applications.
And I was saying that's similar to a SAN.
Very similar. Yeah. A SAN, the magic of a SAN is it's a big box full of drives and a bunch of intelligence that sits on a network somewhere. And you can slice and dice it up and give storage to whomever, whenever, so that you can grow that, shrink it, and you never have to interrupt the system and the users in order to do that. Whereas normally you got to break open your box, pull out your hard drive, and monkey with it, and everybody goes down. So for a company, that's a really big advantage.
And that's what's happening is as even very small companies start relying more and more on data, it's difficult to say, well, my server's over there and it handles everything when there's only one hard drive in there and all of your records are on it. That's really dangerous. And so instead of having a really good backup routine, you actually have a storage network that handles all the storage and you know it's reliable.
Yeah.
That's kind of it
becomes the place where you deal with all of your storage tasks, and that means things like doing backups, doing file sharing, expanding the capacity as your company grows. There's a new technology called server virtualization that's out there that, you know, most end users don't have any experience with this, but if you're at all involved in IT, you've heard of VMware, you've probably seen their stock, it's been ferociously successful. Yeah. Server virtualization changes the way computer networks run in the background. And network storage is one of the key enabling technologies.
Cool. Thanks for the update. I thought it was kind of interesting stuff.
Well,
point of confusion is SAN and NAS.
It absolutely is. And I get tired of explaining it. So I think one of the cool things, NetApp, my company, does a unified file, provides unified storage services. So it doesn't matter anymore whether you need NAS or SAN. One system does it all.
But with this thing, you're still going to need a pretty... on top of the IT guy to set it up?
Well, the store vault division...
you're just lobbing these right over to me here. I'm so sorry, man.
Jeez. The store vault division, the group that I work for at NetApp, builds products for small and medium businesses designed for people who aren't storage experts, aren't computer geeks at dealing with NAS versus SAN, et cetera. So you can be familiar with Windows, buy one of these, plug it in, turn it on, and it'll work, and you can do either one. And earlier this week, we announced a product that starts at $3,000.
Oh, so they're getting cheaper, yeah.
Yeah, for the first
time.
Like
a product brochure, doesn't he?
He does.
You work for who?
Hey, now, this is what I do for a living. Don't knock it.
All right. Let's get on with this. You do for a living, and we're going to knock it.
It rolls right off the tongue. You sound quite eloquent.
Oh, well, thank you.
He's got such a friend of mine says, you know, I talk about the geeks. I go, yeah, and Drew, blah, blah, blah. And he'll go, oh, is that butter voice?
Like, yeah, that's butter voice.
You're known as the
I need
the
to be doing
voice.
Some more radio work.
Oh, look, don't worry about it. Among his friends, I'm known as the evil geek. So, yeah.
All right. Next news story.
You've got to talk to someone.
So we talked about Leopard at length last week. I don't want to talk about it a lot this week, but something that came up interesting is Apple got knocked for their security on the new Leopard product. Namely, their firewall, the integrated firewall, was heavily criticized as one being disabled by default when it's installed. And if you had it enabled and you upgraded to Leopard, it's, again, disabled.
Mm-hmm.
Two, it's not port-based filtering. It's application-based, which I've never personally understood. I don't like that. And there have been... another thing that they've got is that even if it's full restrictive setting, block all incoming traffic, there's still access to some system services from the internet, which is really weird.
That is weird.
Yeah.
So the idea with the firewall built in the machine is that you'd be able to say you can't access this machine except for through these specific communications mediums. And that's what a traditional ports, basically.
Yeah.
And this one's saying you can't access this machine except for by these applications. And then those applications technically could open up any ports they want. That seems a little strange.
Yeah. Well, Windows kind of does that too. Uh-huh. You know, in some degrees, it's easier for users to interface with the firewall because you get a little pop-up saying, hey, this application would like to access the internet. Do you want to provide permission for that? And then basically whatever ports it needs to use, it opens up and it's bound to that application. But... you know, it's kind of hokey. You know, I don't know of many people in the industry going, yeah, you want to use the Windows firewall, it's great. You know, most people say turn it off and use a third-party product that's a little more serious. Or, you know, personally for me, I don't typically need to even use the internal firewall because I've got a router or I'm behind the firewall of my company.
Except that when you're plugged into a network, any network you're plugged into, anybody in that network has access to your machine. And if they're scanning it and looking for vulnerabilities without the firewall, that's one less ease for them to get into your machine.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like that it's turned off by default. It's kind of like I'm assuming it's done that way because there's a bit of administration costs and they're trying to make it really simple for the user. So I can see that rationale.
Yeah, I'm not really quite sure why Apple did that. I haven't heard any feedback from them in regards to this security issue.
But. Speaking of security on an Apple machine, I was reminded recently that one of the recommendations to do is make sure you have two accounts on your machine. One is an admin account and one is the user account you normally use.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll be prompted when you're using the user account to install applications and stuff, and you just use the username and password of the administrative account when you want to do those things. It's a much more hardened machine. It's a good way of using mm-hmm. Apple. All right, let's move on. Thank you very much. Oh, actually, it's mid-break point, so... Speaking of butter voice, we'll hear him in just a second. GeekSpeak is supported by Business of Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley, offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, notary public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. You're listening to GeekSpeak. We're now taking your calls with questions and comments of technology. The numbers are 476-2800. Again, that's 476-2800. Or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, 1-800-655-5877. KUSP. And of course, you're welcome to send us email. Go to geekspeak.org.
Which one are we doing here? Is this Henry J. Ramirez?
The top
or?
One. No, the top.
Okay.
Top.
Do you have some Barry White for the background?
We don't need Barry White. That's the point.
KUSP co-sponsors UCSC Arts and Lectures presentation of Ravi Shankar's Festival of India. Ravi Shankar will perform with daughter Anushka Shankar and an outstanding ensemble for an evening of Eastern classical music. Performance is Sunday, November 4th at 8 p.m. for the Santa Cruz Civic Auditorium. For tickets and more information, please call 459-2159 or visit online at santacruztickets.com.
This is KUSP Central Coast Public Radio. You're listening to GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. That was Drew Meyer. We also have Ryder Brooks and Miles Elam. We're taking your calls with questions and comments of technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. And you can send us email by going to geekspeak.org. Stay with KUSP for Castle Cottage this morning at 11 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio. Now, I want to be clear that we'll take any calls you could possibly ask us. We'll probably answer them incorrectly, but we're welcome to take the calls. The phone number is, again, 476-2800. Again, 476-2800. Toll free at 1-800-655-5877. That's 1-800-655-KUSP. All right, we already got some calls, so let's go ahead and start taking it, I think.
What's that? Like right? Yeah, Uncle Dennis.
All right, where's Dennis from?
Santa Cruz. Oh, it looks cool. Like. Here he comes. As soon as we twist a few knobs and turn the dials.
Uncle Dennis, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Uncle Dennis.
What's your question today?
Okay, I'm building a network-attached storage unit.
Nice. Why?
I put together a $20 computer with an $80 hard drive in it. I loaded Xubuntu as the operating system on the box, and I need... What I'm trying to do is to get Windows 2000 or Windows XP to attach to it. So far, I've managed to mount the drives from the Windows boxes, but when I attempt to transfer data, in other words, read and write storage, it tells me that permission denied.
Okay, Dennis, you're making the world a hurt for yourself here.
Yeah, you're not buying a NetApp product.
No, that was better, not me.
If you can supply a local community unlicensed radio station with a network attached storage box for less than $100 that's reliable, do it.
Well, here's the thing. Why are you using... Is that me that's making all that horrible racket?
It's a difficulty with the phone system. Yeah.
So I will talk softly. So Dennis,
well, let's not discourage him. Let's talk about.
There's some choices here. Let me ask a few questions. Why are you using Ubuntu for this?
Wait, hold on 1 second before we go on, because I've run across this problem before, and the issue he's running into is the fact that it's mounted as root, and therefore only the root user can write to that mounted drive. So that's your fundamental problem. Now, go ahead, Drew.
And
Miles has a solution.
Right. Which
okay.
That's an indication of the big problem, which is dealing with permissions between Windows and Unix is going to be challenging for you.
Right. I set up a Samba user with a password, and that's the user that's trying to log in from the Windows machine.
Are you using your Ubuntu server for other applications or strictly as a NAS?
Strictly as a NAS.
Ditch Ubuntu and go download free NAS instead. Or there are two. There's FreeNAS, and I think there's OpenNAS or another one, which is an open source program, so it's absolutely free. It'll run on the hardware like you have, and it's a web browser interface strictly designed around storage and does all the great things that you're going to need around storage. So it'll simplify what you're doing.
Well, that's a great suggestion. I really appreciate it. I would have.
I know, it's hard. Now you know. It's too late. You already installed your box. But, you know, if you want to learn about the fundamentals of storage and storage networking, then tinker around with Ubuntu and deal with the shares and the permissions and the management. But you're running a lot of extra stuff on that Ubuntu box you don't necessarily need to. And I'm guessing for $20, it's not the sturdiest of hardware that you can
Well, learn. Actually, as a computer engineer, it's pretty bomb-proof.
Oh, okay.
Well, Dennis, I got a question for you.
Pentium 3-1000 and
So yeah, it's not bad.
So the share that you did mount, the new drive that you're going to be using as your storage.
Here's a point of technicality. You would mount an export. You would share a share.
Well, I'm talking about
for Windows.
I'm talking about from the Ubuntu machine.
And we're talking XP to
right.
Ubuntu.
I'm not even talking about that yet. I'm talking about from the Ubuntu machine when you've mounted that share.
Map a share.
Well, in mount using FSTab.
Okay.
When you've mounted that share in FSTab. Do you have that entry in FSTab right now? Okay. When you go to that mount point, and you do like an LL-LA, you do a listing. Does it show SMB as writable to that folder or to that share?
No, it doesn't, and that's the problem.
Yeah. So the command you want to run as an admin user into the machine. And SMB should not be an admin user. What you want to do is make sure you know the username of the SMB. It's probably just SMB user. Go into that share after it's been mounted, and in the root of that share, if you will, or that mount point, you want to run sudo space chmod.
Change the permissions.
I'm sorry, chown.
Yeah.
And then the username SMB, and then put a dot, spaces in between. And what that will do is say, at the current location, I want SMB to be the owner of it.
Okay, let me get that right. Is SUDO?
Yeah, that allows
CHON
W-N, C-H-O-W-N,
C-H-O-W-N, S-M-B dot.
Well, S-M-B space dot.
Space dot.
So the commands for, and you can do a man, M-A-N, on C-H-mod, which is change mod, or change own, excuse me, C-H-own.
Okay.
And what you're basically doing is you're saying, hey, computer system, change the owner of this folder to be this user SMB. And so you say change owner to you to the current, you know, to this user that I'm passing, and I want to reference the current folder, which is the dot.
So, okay. Dennis, why are you sharing files? Are there other people on your network?
Because our current hard drive setups are overloaded. This is another station here, and we have lots and lots and lots of music files, over 100 gigabytes of music files. And, of course, our programmers want more.
Wait a sec. Let me clarify one more thing. There are a bunch of people accessing this Ubuntu box as the file server?
Yeah, but they're all one user.
It's a home. Okay. It's a home kind of network solution. Everybody's friendly there.
Yeah. Well, the other option is you could use iSCSI and turn this into a SAN, which would be a little bit better performance for you. It means that everybody would go through one host, and all this would be just storage off of the back of that host.
So what you do then is you're taking the Windows machine and you're installing stuff, and you're then targeting that box as a hard drive.
Everybody would go to the Windows machine, and behind the Windows machine would be a giant hard drive, this $80 hard drive that you've got, except instead of being a hard drive connected with a serial ATA cable, it would be actually a whole other computer with a hard drive in it connected over Ethernet. It would look and behave exactly the same.
Okay, well, that's sort of what we're trying to do, because our current computer box already has four hard drives in it. It overheats.
Yeah.
Da, da, da.
Well, Dennis, I think you're pretty close to what you want. Just change the ownership to the correct user, SMB user, then you should be okay.
You're running RAID, man. Don't risk that data.
That's true.
Check out FreeNAS and or OpenFiler. And OpenFiler has snapshots, which you ought to use as well.
One thing I haven't heard yet in the discussion is when you're mounting it, to make sure that you have a group ID specified. So you have a particular user that you're logging, that you're connecting as, but you probably want to have a particular group.
Now, are you talking about inside Ubuntu?
Inside the FS
Inside
tab.
Ubuntu, yeah. But see, you don't need to do that, assuming you just, because the root can manage it, and then you can just use the file permissions to actually
unless define you want to write to it, unless you want to have users come to it, because you don't want to have users as root.
No, of course, but if in the suggestion I'm making, isn't that mount point modifiable through Unix permissions, just like any other folder?
The directory once you get onto the drive, those files will have the permissions of whatever you set up in the fstab file.
No, but that's not true. Because if you make a new directory,
now you guys see why I'm confused. When I go out on the Xubuntu user documentation, all this gets really
permissions between, especially in a mixed environment, are a nightmare. Go with iSCSI and get rid of the whole problem.
Hold on, you have a very simple environment. I'm going to give you a very simple answer. There are two sets of users that are going on: the Windows user, and which is what you're mounting from, and the Unix user file system. And the easiest way that I can think of to deal with this is to have when you're mounting, to have it just be a simple, it's mounted as a single user, single group that has read-write permissions. Now, there's the login with Samba, logging into the Windows. That's one. But what you need to worry about is...
Already. We have a Samba, there's a Samba user and a password, and that's what I'm using, that user and password to log in from the Windows.
Right, and then you need the user on Unix.
And that's been set up. Yeah, same user, same
right,
password.
Right, but we're going to have to go on, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Why don't you send us an email? We'll definitely take this a little bit more with some command lines for you, and I'll try to post that stuff on the website as well. Thank you, Uncle Dennis, for the call.
And thank you very much. This has been a challenge for me, and it's sort of a fun little project. It's just that I got down to the sort of the last minute, and that's sort of...
Well, shoot us an email. We'll definitely help you out. Thank you very much for the call.
Thank you, Ryan. Bye-bye.
The nature of storage administration.
I was actually
never a problem until the last second, and it's the biggest problem.
And we've actually had people tell us, you know, sometimes the show just isn't geeky enough.
Oh, that's geeky enough.
Oh, man, we drowned you in geek there.
We just turned away 80% of our audience. All right.
Wait a minute, I loved it. Come on.
And in fact, the 20% of the audience is still here.
Yeah, the guy who dedicates his career to storage loved the conversation about storage.
How did that happen?
Speaking of FreeNAS, have any of you guys used that? I read a review on it, but it sounded very intriguing, and that might – good suggestion, I thought.
If you have the time and you're really conscious about cost, then check out OpenFiler or FreeNAS. I prefer OpenFiler because of the snapshot capability. Snapshots are point-in-time online backups. Get rid of tape. You know,
does it have the same minimal hardware requirements?
Yeah, as FreeNAS has? It's based on
a. It was like a 32 megabyte.
You can boot some of this stuff off of a flash drive.
It's really pretty cool stuff. It's basically.
But you got to have the time. The whole trade-off here is your time. You got to geek out enough to get this all to work.
All right, from I don't know where you're calling from, Anita. Welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question today? Where are you calling from? First off,
Santa Cruz.
Oh, good. What's your question?
I have a problem with my laptop computer that came up yesterday. It's an HP laptop. It's got an XP system on it. And all I could get out of it was a message that said Windows could not start because the following file is missing or corrupt. And it's Windows /System32/config/System. And it goes on to say select R at the first screen to start repair with the operating system CD, so I put that in, got to the R, pressed that, and it kept asking me for a Windows file number, and I could find nothing in any of the support guides or the help features that listed any kind of number.
Oh, serial number. Oh, okay.
Well, no, it will only accept a single digit. A single digit, which had me...
This is during the repair process?
Have you tried all 10 of them?
It wouldn't even... it's after I selected R for repair.
Uh-huh. Oh,
it's asking for probably a partition. And it's asking you what the operating system...
And says, you know, what Windows file number do you want to repair? And there's no number.
I think it's looking for the file system that contains the Windows operating system, because you could have multiple file systems that it could be looking to repair.
This is heavy-duty stuff. You run the risk of losing some data if you do the wrong thing. I mean, it's possible.
Yeah.
So you might want to get a friend or take it to a shop. This is, I mean, it sounds to me like there's been some corruption in the boot sector somehow.
Yeah, it might be. There's another thing that you see every once in a while. Someone's trying to... Before this happened, did you, like, follow some instructions on getting rid of a virus or anything?
No. Okay. One unusual thing I noticed, though, was just kind of random chirping noises for the last couple weeks.
Your hard drive's dying.
Right.
You don't want to repair this system. You need to get a new hard drive.
Run away.
So I'd recommend, since you're in Santa Cruz, a couple days ago my DSL modem died, and I went down to Santa Cruz Electronics to get another one, and then that piece of machine reworked for a couple days. I was able to get it right away because I'm in Santa Cruz, right? And it worked for a couple days, and then it died. And so then I'm like, oh, no, do I have to send this back? It's for warranty and everything. I call Santa Cruz Electronics. They're like, oh, come on down. So I come down. I returned to them without a receipt because they had the serial number on file. They're totally nice. And I got another piece of product that they had. And it was just so wonderful to interact with a human being and buy that. In any case, they have a whole tech support section at Santa Cruz Electronics, and you can take your machine in and get a repair. What's going to have to happen for your machine is somebody's going to have to get another hard drive, install Windows on it, and then try to mount your hard drive at the same time and copy your data over. And basically the hard drive is failing, and that's what's occurring. Anytime a hard drive is chirping away in a new way, like you haven't seen it before.
I've never heard it.
Yeah, it's time to deal with it immediately, because that means that drive's about to fail. And so what finally happened is that system file is the first file that it really can't read. And so it's dying on you.
Yeah. You might have had other corruption, but this is the first one that prevented it from booting.
All is not lost. Take it to someone who can help you with this. It's more than you ought to try at home.
And try to stop running that machine.
Yeah, it's good, well, it a good chance you can recover your data.
Do you have backups?
Do anything? No, that's my big concern. I haven't done backups.
The data might be okay. I mean, some of it.
Yeah, we have no idea now. Crystal ball.
Don't take it to someone and you know, the problem that you run with, like, trying to have HP support help you is that they're really fond of just blasting the disk and the operating system and reinstalling from scratch as all else fails, and you often will delete your data in the process. Or if you go to like Best Buy's or you know, Fry's or someplace that claims to do this level of stuff is sometimes they will just reformat your drive and reinstall and, you know, erroneously assume that you have backups. So.
Yeah, I'm hoping not to do that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you want to find a geek that can install a new hard drive?
So you recommend the geeks at Santa Cruz Electronics?
Well, yeah, I mean, I like them. Miles
Serengeti Systems is a good place, too. And there's a couple of
there's a lot of little shops around.
You know, if it's just this one file that it has a problem with, I mean, there is definitely a chance that you can get it bootable and get to a stage where you can back up your data.
But don't do that. Don't do that. Don't use
well, I mean, if it's critical data, I mean, and she needs to get it booted.
But still, just install on a different drive and try to copy the data.
That's what I'm saying. Trying to do any kind of repair to this drive just means more writes and reads, which means more potential of data loss. So
Or a head crash and it's all over.
Yeah, you really want to stop using this drive and get a new computer and throw it in. And if you have a friend's Windows machine, it's not that hard. I mean, it's complicated, but it's not that hard to get this drive in that machine and get the data off of it.
Yeah, I go to someone experienced and...
Someone experienced, I agree too.
Do you think the HP product has some kind of proprietary hard drive?
Absolutely it does not.
The biggest problem I have is that it's a laptop and that getting the machine open and accessing it is going to be hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And I got to say that I find that laptop drives are more susceptible to starting to chirp and then not getting the data back off of them. At least I've had that experience.
Oh, don't say that, man.
Well, you know, it's...
Poor lady.
So I'm saying this for everybody else that's listening. If you hear a chirping of your hard drive for the first time, deal with it immediately. In fact... Mm-hmm. Before you hear a chirping, make sure you have a backup solution.
Well, what would you do once you hear the chirping? What would be...
Turn the machine off and call Santa Cruz Electronics.
Okay. So
no, actually, if a week ago when your machine was still booting and it was chirping, you went and bought like an $80 USB hard drive, plugged in your machine and copied all your important files over, you would have passed the geek test, if you will.
I failed that one.
That's all right.
Hey, I didn't tell you last week. Called in. So.
That's okay.
Advice.
We fail that test all the time.
Yeah.
Good luck with all that.
Thank you so much and good luck.
Well,
Anita.
Thank you.
Certainly.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We fail that test all the time. You've lost data. I've lost data. Anybody else?
Oh, I've never lost data. I'm in the storage business.
I've never lost important data.
I thought I lost our mail March to August.
You just happened to find it again.
I found it again.
I lost my wife's data one time.
That's the one, man.
Oh,
that'll change your backup solution.
I spent $1,000 on a data recovery software from I did. It was a miraculous recovery, but man, it was painful.
I have this great video that I should share with the geeks of
maybe it was $800.
It's like
it's brutal.
It's a talk about a guy that repairs hard drives from a data recovery place, and like these are the steps you want to do yourself. And like one of the things it says, go ahead and open it up. It's okay to open up the drive and stuff. Go look at the little air filter on the side. If there's silver in there, just throw it in the garbage. It's gone. So if there's ever, like, if the enamel, basically, the magnetic material has been ripped off
flying
and thrown
around
off,
in there,
drive is crashed. And that's a great, like, first step. Don't send it to a repair house. Open it. See that. And once you see that, throw it away. And then the next one was all about find the exact same, another machine on eBay with almost the exact same serial number.
Get
and
the
then
same batch of
you
drive.
Can swap some of it. It's kind of interesting.
Oh, also, and Alex brings up a good point, and I've seen this as well. Drive failure is often indicated by very slow performance of the system.
Yes.
If your computer is slowing down, I mean, just ridiculously slow from what you had before, like 1/10 the speed suddenly.
That's a drive.
A lot of times it will be the hard drive. I had that happen on a work laptop before. I was like, what's going on?
Yep.
Is that because it's remapping bad sectors?
Yeah, it's jumping all around trying to find out somewhere to
write.
And
it's trying to read the same sector
over and over again
and hopefully getting a good result until finally it'll try to remap and put into different areas until it runs out of new areas and then just fails.
The more patient you are with your computer and the more forgiving, the bigger trouble you get into.
Well,
this is 5% lower than it was last week. You're going to be fine because you're going to be looking into it and you'll find out the problem is.
Well, it's odd because, you know, these hard drives, at least the SATA and the IDE hard drives, have the smart feature, which I've never found to be smart or useful.
It basically puts you in trouble because it keeps on taking care of it until it's really in trouble.
Yeah, Google actually did an analysis of a large number of drives and found that smart it was kind of predictive, but it wasn't reliable enough to use as a good metric.
Professional storage systems actually take care of that on their own. One reason to
title. At least I know the title for today's show on the podcast. Yeah. It's got to be something about Drew's company.
Oh, well. I didn't say anything. I'm just mentioning
it. All right,
Let's go with Jackie. Jackie, where are you calling from?
San Joaquin.
And how is it there?
It is nice and sunny. I'm standing out in the backyard.
All right, cool. So what's your question?
I'm calling about phone service through through a cable company, namely Comcast. And I was on an internet web chat room where they were talking about availability or reliability of the telephone service through your cable provider. And for instance, if the power goes out, do you need power to get phone service through your cable system?
Yes, you do.
Yeah, you could have a like a UPS, some kind of backup storage to power all the equipment in your house, but then you're assuming that the local cable station is going to have power, and they probably won't.
Well, I can tell you my experience locally with it, because I have basically the same setup. Is they came in, and it's pretty fresh. I've had it for about a month. They have these MTA units. I forget what the acronym stands for, but it's basically your cable modem for your internet combined with your phone service. And you have your phone line that plugs into the back of it. It can route through your house networking, or you can attach a phone directly. It's got a little battery in it that basically acts as a mini UPS. And the technician that came out says it lasts about 3 or 4 hours. It's provided so you can get emergency phone service. You know, you can dial 911 if something horrendous goes wrong in your house and you have no power.
This is really interesting. This is really important because this is for industrial use. And actually, I'm a fire marshal, and this is a fire marshal chat. And when you have an alarm system in your building, you know, fire alarm, that has to have a backup battery of so many hours.
Right.
And that's also tied into a phone line, which doesn't go down when the power goes out.
Right.
And so that was the chat room, is that the backup battery that Comcast provides is less time than what's required for a fire alarm system.
Right. Oh. And that makes sense. So, Well, what you'd want to do is set up an external another UPS that powers it even longer. And you can get these, like, UPS, this is an uninterrupted power supply. And
it's basically
a large battery, and you can plug things into that. It's very equivalent to the emergency lighting systems in that it'll start working only when the power is out.
What is the minimum time that you're looking to get out of it?
24 hours.
Okay. Yeah. They said maximum
Comcast,
like 7 hours.
Yeah, and Comcast comes with just like 16 hours.
But the other thing to think about is the phone system up for 20? Like, if your local phone distro runs out of power, they've got a lot of battery and they're going to run for a while. But after a certain period of time, the phones will stop working. Now, I grew up in the San Lorenzo Valley where power went out for days at a time, and it seems like the phones were always up. But cable, forget it. You know, so it concerns me the switch over to cable.
Yeah, it concerns me too. Actually, even people going to cell phone, you know, because you don't have 911 coverage anymore. Mm-hmm. So for the fire department, this is a really big deal when people.
What do you mean cell phones don't? Oh, because the cell phones go out when the power goes out.
Well, no, and cell phones still don't reliably contact your local 911. You dial 911 on your cell phone, it's still likely that you're going to get CHP, not your local police department.
Right. So really, you should be programming your phone with your local police department.
Yeah, you should. You should. And at home, you ought to keep really one landline.
Mm-hmm. Right. Alice, well, Comcast claims if you keep your records current with them as to what your address is and where you're located, that you should get routed correctly. I've never had to test it.
You're talking about Comcast phone system.
Yes.
Oh, she's talking about cell phones, too. But
Alex brings up a good point that UPS is probably a bad idea. You want to get a generator. A small portable generator.
Probably.
Well, that's the whole thing with fire alarm systems. Everything has to be listed and certified by certain agencies. So this is kind of an interesting. That's kind of interesting. So anyway, you help me out.
You know, are you the one that is in charge of in the area that you cover saying yes or no to a new system?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I think what you need to do is say no by default about Comcast, and if you have a corporation that wants to use Comcast as their phone service, then they better come up with a plan that falls under the same, you know, best practice, if you will, as a phone system. And one thing, I think you should go ahead and contact local Comcast, because they're going to be very interested in helping you solve this problem, because they're going to lose a whole bunch of customers based off of your solution.
Yeah, well, yeah. And this is actually a chat room from some people in Southern California. And so I haven't had anyone come to me yet with this particular question, but it was on the chat room, and it was like, whoa.
It's just a matter of time, too.
One more new problem.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for the call, and thanks for your work.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Oh, we have time for another call, I believe. I've lost our chat. You guys are chatting a lot on our chat.
All kinds of ideas flowing around here.
We have John from Paso Robles.
Paso Robles, okay. No, John's not on the phone anymore. Let's see.
John was patient.
No, we lost John. All right, so no more calls right now.
Well, his question had to do with setting up a PC to be a DHCP server.
Yeah, based on what we saw.
With this current router.
Yeah, take a crack at that, Miles.
So what's going on is a lot of times the what happens when you turn on a computer that doesn't have an IP address when you're going to a router to give you an IP address, basically the computer says, hi, is anyone out there? And then a DHCP server will say, oh, yeah, here, you are IP address 192.168.1.5.
Mm-hmm.
And your computer says, hey, thanks, okay, and gets all your DNS information. But if you have more than one DHCP server on a network, they're both going to try to communicate with that desktop. So the desktop's going to be hearing two different sources telling it two different things. How I usually get around that is turning off the DHCP on one of the setups.
On
and just have and just make sure you only have one on the network.
You know, let's keep going with the VoIP call. We have Brant from Santa Cruz. Hey, Brant, what's up?
Well, I just wanted to reinforce what you guys were just saying to the woman from the fire department.
Mm-hmm.
The only reliable communication method that I know of right now is your plain old telephone system.
Copper
you can't
pots.
Depend upon Comcast. They have line amplifiers in the cable systems who may or may not have power.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. So I went through this with the City of Santa Cruz Fire Department a couple of years ago.
Uh-huh.
And people weren't even aware of the fact that the cell phone system
has
got about an
thing.
Hour's worth of battery and then it's gone.
Right.
Until they get the generators up. So I just wanted to add that.
Well, so this is Brant, KSP's engineer. So Brant, why isn't the cable company, why aren't they dealing with this issue? Because, of course, this is like a primary concern in that even if you don't, if you have a phone line connected to your house and you haven't paid the bill, you can still dial 911 from it.
Right.
So how is Comcast dealing with this idea of we want to be your new phone without handling this major problem?
I don't know. I think that's a good question for Comcast.
Yeah. So, Ryder, you've got a kid and you're in your house and you don't have a normal phone line. Do you feel safe about being able to contact 911?
As long as the power's up and it's working, yeah. I mean, to be honest, I haven't put a great deal of thought on it. I mean, you know, there's neighbors, there's cell phones. I have not had a single problem with Comcast.
Okay, so you're just willing
to be. I've never had to call 911 in my life,
yeah.
So it's not something I've personally had to put a great deal of thought on. I don't work for the fire company.
That's the thing. It's kind of like backup solutions, right? You don't really think about it until you need it. And that's the concern I have is that people are switching away from the idea of having this really great, you know, social service to a situation where they don't really have it and they don't even know it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of like, you know, not taking care of your backup solution.
I don't know. It's something I should probably actually talk with my wife about. You know,
yeah, I mean, and maybe the solution is, well, we have a backup plan for if our phone goes out, we've got the cell phones, and then if that happens, we do this. And the other thing is, you know, where do you meet up if you guys are split and there's a problem? And anyway, Brant, thanks for calling up and mirroring our concern, and thanks for listening to GeekSpeak.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye. Well, we're coming down to the wire. We're about to start our kids program, so stay with KUSB for Cast Cottage just a couple more minutes. The geeks this morning were Miles Elam. Thank you, Miles, for being here.
Glad to be here.
Ryder Brooks.
Hi.
Thanks for testing out VoIP, Voice over IP. Sure. I appreciate that. And Drew Meyer.
All right.
And where do you work again?
Network Appliance, the Storval division. Thank you, Lyle.
GeekSpeak is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation, and offering one-appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. The one at the bottom.
GeekSpeak on KUSP is supported by Santa Cruz
Electric. Not that one. The one above that.
Tune in this afternoon at 5 p.m. for the Planet Cruise Comedy Hour with Richard Stockton, an hour of comedy, songs, and stories by Santa Cruzans and about Santa Cruzans. That's the Planet Cruise Comedy Hour with Richard Stockton today at 5 p.m. on Central Coast Public Radio.
GeekSpeak is registered service mark of Online Tonight and is with David Lawrence and is used by permission. And I'll read this one. GeekSpeak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. Broadcasting HD radio on 88.9 FM. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Otto. We're on the web at kusp.org. You just listened to another episode of GeekSpeak via our podcast. Would you do us a favor?
please go to your favorite podcasting index site, whether it be iTunes, Dig.com, Odeo, or another site, and write a review or give us a vote to let others know what you think about GeekSpeak. Thanks, that'd really help us out. GeekSpeak is supported by PreownedCar.com, PreownedCar.com, where anyone can post their vehicle for sale or browse to purchase a pre-owned car from other car owners. More information available at PreownedCar.com. This is Lyle Troxell for KUSP. Thanks for listening.